It's still the month of October, a month that signifies independence for the Federal Republic of Nigeria, and a month that calls for reflection on our journey as a country. This is National Discourse, a leading socio-political program on Agidigbo 88.7 FM. I am Zainab Sani. This week on National Discourse, we go into the annals of history with a veteran journalist and Nigerian of impeccable standards. Someone who has experienced several decades of the country. My guest is Ambassador Yemi Farumbi, a veteran who has traversed all genres of the motion picture trade. Yemi Farumbi is a former general manager, Nigeria Television Authority, former special assistant to the Oyo State Governor on Broadcasting, Chairman Directorate of Information Oyo State, Chairman Visitation Panel of the University of Benin, a one-time member of the Governing Council of the Yaba College of Technology, Chairman Daily Times of Nigeria. He was also Ambassador of Nigeria to the Philippines, the Chairman of Osun State Broadcasting Corporation, and is currently a member of the Governing Council of Leeds City University. This is part one of a two-part conversation that explores the political undertones of the dynamics shaping governance and development in Nigeria. And I do hope that you enjoy this interview I had with Ambassador Yemi Farumbi. So, I mean, between when you got into the media and 2021, you know, your retirement, and now that we are experiencing yet another democratic government, even though the person in power was formerly a military person, a lot has happened to Nigeria, in the sense that we've had to go through so many coups. Then we've also had elected several republics, right? My interest would be, as at the time that you know, you were actively going after stories, actively interacting with political stakeholders and military stakeholders even, did you see Nigeria going in the direction that it currently is going?
The answer is no. In my wildest dream, or in my worst nightmare, I never expected that Nigeria would be like this. When Nigeria became independent in 1960, and chose October 1, which happens to be my birthday.
Yeah, right.
I was happy. Because I had tremendous hope for Nigeria. Nigeria in 1960 was better than India, Thailand, Singapore, Vietnam, Korea, Egypt, Tunisia, were completely ahead of them. And Nigeria was looked up to as that symbol of excellence, that flag that will fly very high as a symbol of parliamentary democracy in Nigeria. We never expected a country where there'd be no security, where there'd be no safety, where there'd be so much joblessness, where education had collapsed, where the economy had no direction. We never expected that. So we had always thought that Nigeria would be much better than what it is now. But the indications came very early.
You know, I was going to come to that we had the was the optimism punctured pretty early?
Very pretty early. Because by 1962-63, when you started having a crisis in the Western region, Western region was the pace setter. It had started television, commercial broadcasting, a Liberty Stadium, a university, a housing estate, industrial estate. It had been the first region to have minimum wage, to have a pilgrim welfare board. So it was the pace setter. And of course, once it started, the other regions followed. So, and that was good. That competition was heavy for Nigeria.
Mm.
So, when the crisis came in 1962, and there was a fractionalization of the ruling party, and
1962, that would be even before the first coup.
Before the first coup. In fact, that was what led to the first coup.
Hmm.
The federal government became intolerant of the regional government. The MPC from the north collided with the NCNC, broke the western region, created the western Midwest out of it, when there was need also to create other regions like the Middle Belt, like the Calabar Oguja River. They didn't do that. They created a state of emergency in the west. They proceeded, tried to take over National Bank. They eventually installed an emergency government led by Major Kudumi, all within the first 3 years. So they worked over time to decimate the Asher Group, to annihilate the Asher Group. They started the COCA inquiry against Chief Obafemi Awolowo. They ended up arraigning before the court for what they called treasonable felony and sent him for 10 years jail with hard labor.
You know, allow me to come in here and say that there have been insinuations that it was the fact that Nigerians at that time got the independence on a platter of gold that started all of these issues.
I think you are right. It was the only country that didn't fight for independence, so we didn't know the value of it. The struggle for Nigeria independence was largely by the media. It wasn't like in Zimbabwe, Namibia, South Africa, Mozambique, Angola, where they went to war.
Mm.
And there was a lot of shedding of blood. We got our independence largely through very, very powerful editorials and great magisterial columns written by Sad Sam, Sam Amuka, Ebenezer Williams, Peter Enahuru, Alade Odunewu, L.K. Jakande, John West. These were the people who made it impossible for the colonial power to be at peace.
So it was largely a fight of the pen.
It was a struggle of the pen. And that was how we got independence. So we really didn't know what it was. If we had gone to battle, if we lost lives, if there had been numerous detentions, there were a few detentions of Tony Nauru, a few of them like that.
Mm.
If you had a last-scale detention, like you had Nkrumah in prison, he came from prison to become prime minister. If you've had years of imprisonment, like 27 years of Mandela, if you had the UNITA versus MPLA that you had in Angola, if you had the Joshua Ikomo, Robert Mugabe war against the whites that lost
Thomas
blood.
Yes.
If we had all of that, we would have valued it. But we got it rather cheaply. So we lost it rather cheaply too. Political intolerance, political oppression, political intimidation, and not listening to the people any longer. The people were irrelevant, you know. So we had a succession of elections that were massively rigged. The first election that was so rigged was 1964, federal election, when the North thought they could now politically take over the whole of the country. They have allied with the splinter group from the Action Group, the NNDP.
Mm-hmm.
They've allied with the Niger Delta Congress. And they thought with that they can have what they call the NNA, Nigeria National Alliance. And they wanted to take over.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant the progressive West was being excluded, the majority. and the progressive East was being excluded, the progressive Midwest was being excluded. It's not possible to run a government that way. So there was a crisis. There was a crisis between the then president, Ezekwe, and the then prime minister, and whether, based on that election, that was boycotted by the NCNC and the Asher Group in an alliance called OPCA, whether on the basis of which you can really install a prime minister and a government. Eventually, it was resolved the Nigerian way. There was a new election in the East, and they formed a new government that did not include the Asher Group at all. And the West didn't really object too much because they thought there'd be a regional election in 1965, and they'd be able to vindicate the Asher Group by returning Awolowo. And Awolowo had been put in prison.
Okay, now, so you think that the West should have been more insistent at that point in time, you know, before it got to a coup?
Well, if they had been insistent in 64, perhaps we would have been able to rescue it. But they were hoping that there'd be a regional election. And that regional election was massively rigged. Absolutely rigged. Results were being announced on WNTV, WNBA that are complete variance with what was happening on the ground, and the people revolted. People had always underestimated the Yorubas. They had always seen the Yorubas as jayi jayi, who really can't sacrifice their enjoyment, their morun todun, for anything. So nobody expected that the West would react. So they rigged the election, and they thought that was the end. But that was a spontaneous rioting. Houses were burned, vehicles were destroyed, government could not operate, the Western region became ungovernable.
And that's what is now popularly referred to as the Awo Revolt?
Yeah, you call it Operation Wet Hair.
Operation Wet Hair.
And that means, what does it mean? You use petrol to wet the house and then set it on fire. And they did that. And that really showed up the incompetence, the ineptitude, and the partisanship of the federal government. Because that was the time to really have declared a state of emergency in the West. But that was the time the prime minister chose to host a Commonwealth Conference. At a time when Ibadan was burning, they are holding a Commonwealth Conference in Lagos. And that didn't sit well. And it was that uprising that stimulated the younger, the youths in the army, the Gang of Seven, the seven majors, and said, no, you can't run a country this way. A country governed by tribalism, a country governed by 10%, a country governed by religious bigotry. And that was what gave them the energy to stage the coup of January 1966. And even when the coup eventually failed, because it was not correctly executed, because somehow the operationalization of the coup excluded the Igbos of the Midwest and the Igbos of the East. Akintola had been killed in the West. Some Yoruba, like Brigadier Shodende, had been killed. Some Northern military like Brigadier Malamari had been killed, Sadane had been killed, Tafalbariwa had been killed. So it led to the collapse of the coup. But even then, the West didn't care about the coup. For 3-4 months after the military regime of even Irunzi had installed itself, the West was still fighting. They were still in rebellion, open rebellion against government. So, in that circumstance, you had a military leadership in General Irunsi, who never planned a coup, who never knew anything about a coup. I wasn't actually a very brilliant one. Became the head of the army when the whites were going because he was the most senior, not because he was the most competent. In fact, a lot of people thought he was dumb, not too brilliant. And so when he took over, he also allowed, unfortunately, himself to be manipulated by some Igbo intellectuals.
Do you not think that was a response that would have happened anyway, because the central was trying to get as much power, concentrated as possible?
You see, that wasn't a response, because we had a 1960 constitution that was truly federal. We had a 1963 Republican constitution, which is the only constitution since 1914 that was put together under a civilian regime. Is the only truly civilian or generated constitution. Up to 1960, it was under the colonial power. And after 1963, all constitutions, 79, 89, 99, were under the military. So this was the only constitution that the civilian themselves truly gave unto themselves. What we had was a military reaction. Was an Igbo influenced military reaction that tried with a decree number 34, I think it was, of 1966, a unification decree.
Which is where I'm coming to. One of the issues that came up, from the Operation Wet Tear, from the unrest in this West, particularly, I don't want to use the South because that would also include the Igbos, but the West, was the fact that there was some sort of, the central wasn't so strong. It wasn't as strong as the regions. So the military must have thought that if we can make the center very strong, then it would, cut down on the power that the regions have to revolt and to...
Two things. It wasn't the weakness of the center, it was the political partisanship. When there was an eruption in the Western House of Assembly, only one member of the House stood on the table and started saying there's fire on the mountain. They declared emergency. They had powers to declare emergency. Now when there was massive burning of houses, massive looting, massive killing of people, that same government that declared an emergency on the say-so of only one member of the House was BC organizing Commonwealth Conference. It wasn't lack of power. It was lack of will. It was lack of wisdom. The true results of the election were being announced on EMBS, Enugu. Contrary to the falsehood and the lies that were being announced on WMBS. So all government needed to have done, if they actually loved this country, was to have canceled the election and do another election. Particularly since the people were not asking for secession. So the answer to it is not a centralization. But this centralization was based on the failure of an Igbo-driven coup that had led to the appointment of an Igbo military head of state who now thought that, this is our opportunity. Don't forget that in 1947, Dr. Nnamdi Azikiwe said the Igbos are specially selected to rule Africa, not only Nigeria. So they thought they were so educated, they could take over the judiciary, they were more in the army anyway, in the officers' corps. They thought also they could take over the civil service and so on. And it was that fear that led to the May 29, 1966, and the July counter coup. The father, the Northerner, said, you mean that we now have a centralized service, so the Igbo will become permanent secretary in the North, or become principals in government colleges in the north because they were more educated. The north was relying more on imported Pakistani or Indian or Arab teachers. So they didn't like that. And they didn't like the fact that a lot of the northerners were kids, and the only easterner that was kid was the one who had the key to the armory, who refused to give it. So they had a revenge march. And in the revenge march, they massively killed the Igbos who were in the north.
So it was an excessive response, yes. Right?
And of course it was that extensive because they have decided they were seceding from Nigeria. Arab meant we are leaving. Mm. In fact, they have aligned planes, they've sent their families back. The troops, those who stayed the coup, the Muritala, Muhammad, the Danjumas, and all of them had decided that it was time to end Nigeria.
You know, we could run through all of this years, the 1966 coup, the 1975, you know, the 1976, 1983. 1985, 1990, 1993, and then up until we returned finally, you know, let's hope this is the final time we are going to return to a democracy. Now Nigeria has been running a democracy since 1999. Is that to say that we have not learned, we did not learn anything from those struggles we had during military era? Because you pointed out ethnicity, right? One ethnic group feeling it is more superior should be the one in charge than another. You pointed out incompetence. You pointed out a lack of sensitivity from the central government. And when you look at the Nigeria of today, these issues still seem to play out with ethnic wars here and there, the federal government insensitive to the plight of ordinary Nigerians, with massive corruption. Our electoral system is still nothing to write about. Have we not learned anything from the struggles of yesterday?
Obviously, we have not. And partly because sometimes those who struggled for democracy give up too early. Let me give an example. 1999, it was a real struggle. The Nadeko, the Nupeng, the loss of lives, the media was again in the vanguard of it. They tell the news wash, the punch, the tempo, all of them, the guerrilla journalists, the guerrilla warriors, they made life difficult for the military, even when the politicians have found an accommodation with the military government. They are the ones who serve as ministers, they are the ones who serve as commissioners and so on. But the press waged a war, and they've lost a lot of people. Some were missing, some were blown by bombs, some were arrested indefinitely. But as soon as 1999 came, it will appear the media, the pro-democrats, the human rights organization said, thank
finally
God.
The war has been won.
And they went to sleep. Including that they didn't even know what the 1999 constitution looked like. The 1999 constitution came under a decree that was promulgated, and I know that the incumbent president then that was sworn in 29th May 1999,
yes,
never saw the constitution before it was sworn in. So the policing that these agitators ought to have done or ought to have sustained to ensure that yes, we've got civil rule, but to now get democratic rule we have to get the grand norm, which is the constitutional right. They went to sleep. They were happy. And so for years you couldn't get a real headlong attack on the constitution. All you had were marginal changes that suited the political powers. marginal changes about electoral laws, marginal changes about who gets what, but nothing about the substance of the arrangement. So you have the resources domiciled in the center. Not only that, we have moved from a 63 constitution where the center had only 22 items under the federal exclusive list.
Mm.
We have moved to a 1999 constitution where the center now has 88 items, where it became impossible for even the state as a federating unit to create a local government of its own. They can only run the local government that have been created by the military and which have been affected by the naked partisanship and ethnic relationship of the military. I'll give you an example. When 12 states were created in 1967 by Gowon, there was a Kano state and there was a Lagos state. Both of them had 20 local governments.
Mm.
Both of them have a population of about then 5 million or so. From Kano, because the North controlled the military regime, they created the Jigawa state and gave it 34 local governments. The remaining Kano, they gave it 44. Add the two of them together, that's almost 80. But Lagos remained 20.
It does feel like...
And, you know, that inequality will not matter. But when you become you are sharing revenue allocation, you use the number of local government to determine what who gets what.
It does feel like, you know, the feelers I get from what you've said so far is that it feels like Nigeria is not real.
It is not real. It's fake.
And that is it on today's edition of National Discourse, but not the end of this conversation. Next week, I return with the second part of this interview, seeking to answer only one question. How can Nigeria move from 1 to 100%? Thank you for tuning in. You can listen to this interview again online via any of our podcast platforms, including Google, Anchor, and AudioMac. Join me next week on National Discourse on Agidigbo 88.7 FM. I am Zainab Sani.